name is Michael McCusker. Because it is my birthday, I am going to indulge in something. I'm going to read about myself this morning, or at least a part that I played in something 40 years ago in Portland. But before then, I'd like to read a letter I have just written to the Daily Astorian, which might or might not print it. To the editor, now that the Daily Astorian has attempted to balance its alleged liberal agenda with conservative columnist George Will, why not truly initiate journalistic equilibrium in your editorial columns with a socialist? That's it. We'll see if they print it. What I like to read now is about the People's Army Jamboree. 40 years ago, in the summer of 1970, a protest against the American Legion both galvanized and polarized Portland, Oregon. What I am about to read on the air here is a personal recollection, scribbled to assist an interview, and subsequently tampered with by revisions and additions. And I guess I should give my disclaimer that this is perhaps my opinion, and my opinion only, in the entire universe and universes. I spent most of 1966 and a few months of 1967 as a USMC combat correspondent in Vietnam. My job was to travel with infantry, grunts, and sometimes reconnaissance patrols, and record with words and camera our experiences in conflict with Viet Cong guerrillas and North Vietnamese Army. My weapons were an increasingly battered and rusty M14 rifle. I claimed rice grew out of its barrel. Various pens, pencils, and spiral-lined notebooks. And a Nikonos underwater 35mm camera I asked a friend to buy for me cheap in Hong Kong while he was on R&R, which is rest and relaxation, which was usually 5 days in some other Southeast Asian country, or Australia, or Hawaii, which was the only stateside recess from the war. I quickly accepted the war's grim circumstances, but no amount of star-spangled banner justified the horror of indiscriminate eco-genocide against Vietnamese, who mostly died because they are in the way. No medals for bravery, no Purple Hearts for wounds, also no good conduct medal. I survived my one-year assignment to war by embracing a thought that guilt was the provenance of only the living, though I refrained from personal atrocities. Alive and back stateside, I attempted to keep the promise of my accepted guilt. I was an early member of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, VVAW, and organized chapters of disaffected Vietnam veterans all over the country, diminishing my responsibility with successful geographic recruitings until finally I was only a state coordinator for the state of Oregon. My dream of being absolutely free from anti-war obligations were interrupted and dramatically postponed by the student strike at Portland State University in the spring of 1970 and by the People's Army Jamboree late that summer. I was a rather forceful speaker at the time, blunt but oratorical. I could recruit by vigor of voice, but I was inept at keeping the flock my tongue gathered. I was fortunate that ideas and possible political strategies I was able to articulate attracted some who could administer them. The first time I heard about the American Legion's plan for a convention in Portland, the summer of 1970, was the previous December, following a speech I made at the third of the moratoriums held nationwide in the autumn of 1969. A reporter from the Oregon Journal, Keith Tilstrom, also a Vietnam vet, he was in the Army, told me the Legion was coming and suggested something ought to be done to confront their unconditional support of the Vietnam War. He said the most logical opposition would be Vietnam veterans. As it turned out, Vietnam Veterans Against the War spearheaded the protest, but were only a small part of the amalgamation of Northwest anti-war organizations, a hodgepodge mirthfully named the People's Army Jamboree. The VVAW started organizing in early 1968. Its first of many factional divisions resulted from the McCarthy for President campaign, when more extreme vets devoted to urban warfare refused to reorganize into presidential politics. However, from the McCarthy campaign grew a national register of anti-war vets who later joined the VVAW, which, primarily fallow for a year of recruiting and organizing throughout the country, resurged into public notice in the spring of 1970 on 100 campuses during the national college strike against the war. At Portland State University, the vets became medics and inadvertently became focus of the strike when police charged to destroy their ersatz hospital and beat up several demonstrators. I was among them. Confronting the American Legion seemed a high point, a direct challenge to military power, which culminated the following year in the spring of 1971, when the VVAW camped out for a week in Washington, D.C., hurling our war medals at Congress and 100 pounds of chicken defecation from nearby Maryland chicken farms at the Pentagon on May Day. Also, the week following the American Legion convention in Portland, an East Coast contingent of VVAW marched from Morristown, New Jersey, to Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, sweeping through cities and towns along the way, which became famous as a form of unique guerrilla warfare, or guerrilla theater of warfare. The vets pretending to assault actors staged among each village's citizens in the manner we earlier mishandled Vietnamese peasants. The idea of doing something about the presence of the American Legion in Portland was thought about through the winter and spring of 1970. More immediate matters took precedence, but after the PSU strike in May, organizing to protest the Legion convention was a front burner priority. It was unfortunate we had so long to wait, almost 3 months until the Legionnaires marched into the city after the PSU strike. By then, the devil of factionalism had subdivided us almost to the point of dissolution. People who had been recognized as leaders of the local anti-war movement resisted relinquishing stature and power to newcomers, who had evolved into the practical leadership during the strike in May. A new group of leaders emerged from the ranks of barricades persons, who formed a community of spirit while isolating the campus from the outside world for 6 days, living together behind accumulations of furniture and rubbish. The barricade community dominated the strike, and its independent-minded citizenry rebelled against the organizational leadership that remained inside PSU's buildings and issued masses of mimeographed proclamations that were usually ignored. The same shift of power occurred during the organizing of the People's Army Jamboree. The new group which emerged during the strike was voted to lead the PAJ in a tumultuous meeting of some of the most esoteric groups who were to participate, representing most of the variations of Oregon's small counterculture, with the distinct exception of black activist groups. I was elected titular leader of the PAJ because I represented VVAW, which was publicly promoted confronting the Legion. Vietnam veterans were the logical figureheads for our Raggedy Ann clash with the Pentagon's war policies, as signified by elder veterans whose organization rubber-stamped every military ambition and pretension. Ultimately, however, significant power remained with the old leaders, who opened negotiations with Portland city officials for a site in which to encamp whoever came into town to protest, confrontation with the Legion being hailed as a momentous national demonstration by that dethroned group as a means of maintaining their juice. At this point, the two factions started tearing at each other. One attempted to retain control by dealing with the city and encouraging the fear that Portland would be invaded by hordes of hippies. The other split rail, sent out warnings to stay out of Portland because it might be an ambush to cripple the anti-war movement. This faction, the newbies, which included me, also supported the governor's rock festival, Vortex, which was inspired to detour incoming out-of-state demonstrators from Portland and was probably the most notable event of that summer. Our support was from concern that police did not distinguish pot-smoking music lovers from hardcore political dissenters. With the cultural side of the counterculture removed, the streets of the city were open to the political side, which would be free from worry that its activities would harm the spaced-out innocents. I was not a very good organizer, but I had talent as a front man. I made speeches, was interviewed by local and network radio and television, and also newspapers and wire services. I was allowed semi-equal time on the local TV and radio media to counter a rather hysterical diatribe by Governor Tom McCall against the People's Army Jamboree, which I compared to a speech by Adolf Hitler in the early 1930s to clear away public opinion for the upcoming Final Solution. I spent little time in an office rented in the city's Burnside district for organizing the demonstration. Many people worked long hours every day without pay to put the affair together. I played grasshopper. When my presence or tongue were required, I was usually found at Reuben's Five Tavern. I used to think Reuben's Five regulars were queen bees of the liberated future. Maturity unblinkingly redefines us as just another tavern crowd, despite our exotic disguises, esoteric philosophies, and wanton behavior. Yet in the summer of 1970, we bartenders at Reuben's Five arranged our working schedules around our political activities. Reuben's Five was our center. We drank wine and smoked illicit drugs outside and dithered about arcane and esoteric particles of political theory, none of which would survive reality but sounded impressive at the bar. Reuben's Five was at its peak that summer, featured in local and national media as the colorful headquarters of the baby boomer rebels. Hunter Thompson commanded several tables throughout the Legion convention, a blonde woman and a dark-haired woman on either side of him as bookends. Reporters sought and interviewed me at Reuben's Five in the weeks before our intensely advertised Clash of Generations, soon to appear live in Portland, while police agents sat at the bar and pretended to be part of the gang. Articles and newscasts escalated the tension, as did rumors that a hippie army planned to invade and take over Portland, and the city's commercial stock of aerospray oven cleaner was sold out, either to residents to be used in defense against forceful left-wing demonstrators, or by left-wing radicals to use against police, depending upon the source of gossip. There were also rumors and substantial evidence that a trap was about to be sprung on us. The city was to be packed with police from all over Oregon and most of the state National Guard. The rest would surround the revelers at Vortex, which was set up in Clackamas County in the mid-Willamette Valley. A U.S. Army unit from Fort Lewis was to be stationed just across the Columbia River in Washington State. A few of us suspected a slaughter, a testing of how much public opinion would be strained by massacring a bunch of dope-smoking, long-haired, supposedly commie-simp, usually white hippies in a far-off, not very important city in the upper left edge of the country. The previous year, police had attacked and killed several Black Panthers in a number of cities with hardly a murmur from the mainly white mainstream, known then as the silent majority. The Portland media portrayed the People's Army Jamboree as if it intended to maraud the city like a biker gang. Sympathetic National Guardsmen told us they were being trained in summer camp to attack hippies. Perhaps the sum of these parts didn't add up to our paranoia, but we who were paranoid would have been irresponsible to not attempt to prevent the possible disaster we were paranoid about. We few conspirators staged a clandestine operation to keep people out of Portland. We sent messages and made telephone calls to radical groups all over the country, warning them and explaining we didn't desire to attract fatal attention. We also allied ourselves with the efforts to organize Vortex, which would draw off the non-political hippies and suck up out-of-staters on the road to Portland. We told everybody else that this was our demonstration, and we wished to do it by ourselves. In the meantime, we participated in negotiations with the city. We applied for parade permits and argued for the use of a city park for our counterculture encampment. We wanted beautiful Washington Park for our campground, which we visualized as a final romp of flower children among the park's famous roses. We got, instead, Delta Park, former site of the city of Vanport, which was washed away by a Columbia River flood on Memorial Day, 1948. Frank Ivancy was city parks commissioner. We all considered him an evil, ambitious man, perhaps our single consensus, whose duplicity had caused bloodshed during the spring student strike. Ivancy made headlines resisting our arguments for a park and condemned our plans of protest as traitorous and communist-inspired. He later used media accounts of his stout resistance to hippie disruption, with a photograph of me and a man who later became a court judge here in Oregon, as villains in his campaign literature for mayor, which he eventually became after three attempts and was not reelected. Bud Clark took his place. So we bickered with the city for most of that summer while dreaming up a demonstration schedule as logistically complex as a military campaign. We were bequeathed $10,000 by a local potato chip heiress, and we rushed to waste the money as rapidly as we could. Some very sophisticated radio equipment was purchased, ostensibly to monitor police and National Guard movements during our days of rage. A local hippie lawyer was given $1,000 as a retainer for a possibly heavy caseload in the near future. Another grand was used to purchase an offset printing press from a state auction, which printed small poetry books for years afterward. An uncounted and unattributed amount of the $10,000 disappeared into throats, noses, lungs, and bellies, wine, food, and drugs. Probably the worst that can be done with a fringe group is give it money. Fights break out immediately as to where the money will go and to whom. Entire movements have been torn up arguing about money donated by sympathetic sponsors. That $10,000 almost disintegrated the People's Army Jamboree, and by the time we were able to regroup, half the money had been spent with little accounting of where it disappeared. We worked for most of the rest of the money we received, hats in hand. In my case, tongue out of cheek. A TV appearance or a guest shot on talk radio was good for several bucks in donations, as were speeches at open or closed gatherings of diverse radical and liberal groups engaged in various agendas. I was even a guest speaker at a luncheon of the Inner Sanctum of Portland Political Economic Muscle, the City Club, though I don't believe I received any donations for the People's Army Jamboree. A ticket for me to get out of town might have been a more popular fundraiser. By the time the American Legionnaires marched into Portland, everything seemed anticlimax. Tensions and fears had been so relentlessly exploited in the weeks and days before their arrival that the event itself was played through at half speed with a large sense of déjà vu. We conducted our descent peaceably to the contempt of the national press, which had gathered in Portland and considered our lack of bloodshed the mark of lightweights. A columnist for the Washington Post, Nicholas von Hoffman, wrote, "The People's Army Jamboree is a lot like the Loch Ness Monster. Everybody's talking about it, but nobody has ever seen it." I presented an idea at the final hysteria-pitched meeting of the PAJ crowd before Legion Week, which I thought was a radical departure from standard radical practice. A young girl walks through the city's deserted streets. She's about 8 years old. Her hair is long. She wears a dress. She carries a flower in one hand and a sign in her other hand. "In the War" is printed in bright paint on the sign, which is a piece of wood nailed to a stake. She walks down the middle of several streets. On each side of every street, against buildings or grouped in open spaces, are armed policemen and state National Guardsmen. They watch the girl menacingly. She sings only one song, over and over, "We shall overcome." The girl would have to be 8 or 9, not much older, or she risked rape. It would be a feast for television, I argued. Just a lone little girl, virginal, anyone's daughter or little sister, marching past the assembled might of the government. Look at the contrasts. Focus on the little girl in the empty streets. Close-ups of snarling cops wrapping their palms with nightsticks, National Guard soldiers with bayoneted rifles waiting, various forms of paralyzing gases in handheld canisters. News anchors' imperious voices edged with contempt at the uniformed brutes clustered in sinister ambush to molest the lone nymphet. Perhaps split-screen the little girl with marching American Legionnaires. No chance. The crowd had wanted to march en masse. Do the usual hippie demonstration shtick. After most of a summer spent in tense anticipation and growing public hysteria for our spectacular, no one wished to stay out of whatever action was ahead. Everybody was impatient for the performance to begin. Yet for all that tense impatience, we were obsolete at the very moment of our presence. The real war was for racial and sexual equality as well as for economic justice. Our protest of an unpopular war was a brief recess from more enduring struggles. Everywhere the People's Army Jamboree appeared that week, the Legion was in town. It was ringed with concerned citizens who offered themselves as a buffer between us and the armed forces of law and order. They were a well-publicized group that called itself People for Portland and included nuns and ministers as well as average, everyday folk who were worried about violence between police and hippies, among them a gubernatorial candidate defeated in the 1994 state Republican primary and later fled Oregon to avoid investors who claimed he bilked them out of millions of dollars. Encounters with police were mild, which probably disappointed a few on both sides of the People for Portland rings. My own tactics to keep the trigger on safe were to roam among demonstrators and quell outbreaks as they occurred, which usually meant pointing out troublemakers as police provocateurs, some of whom probably were. I didn't care. My intent was to isolate belligerent loudmouths before they caused the police to attack. We had a few undercover agents and informers within our ranks. One was a young rookie policeman who had been a Marine in Vietnam and intentionally bonded with me from that mutual experience. He fooled me, and I defended him against accusations that he was a spy. Yet he was a factor that none of us were arrested. Instead of provoking us to violence, which were probably his original orders, he defended us, reporting to his chief that we did not intend to commit any form of violence or illegal acts and were prepared to prevent violence and crime within our ranks. Another reason we might not have been put in jail was more obscure and involved a chance meeting with Oregon Governor McCall. My friend, Sailor John McGarrity, whose political grasp was brilliant, and I were walking downtown one afternoon a few weeks before Legion Week. We discovered McCall at the center of a small crowd cutting a ribbon to something, flanked by stacks of watermelons. Sailor and I instantly agreed I should talk with the governor, which I did as he walked a few blocks to his limousine. McCall was a tall man with a lanky stride. I almost ran, keeping a pace with him while rapidly filling him in on our intentions, and warned him when he reached the car, his bodyguards politely behind us, that our informal chat could cause him to be subpoenaed if any of us were arrested. We marched three times through Portland streets. I made speeches before each march, but as a male, was dissuaded from the second march, which was organized and conducted by feminists. I lost all copies of my first two speeches, which, if the third is an example, is not a great loss to history. My rhetoric was full sail as I whipped up the crowd for a final effort. We walked into an armed camp, unarmed, against three times our number, I said of the first two marches. We walked into the barrels of rifles aimed at every one of us. We brushed against the teeth of the lion and came back out again. We showed them our courage against their hostile, brutal fear, and we refused to play their game. We refused to give them any reason for their club-swinging orgasms. I felt like I imagined Billy Sunday felt, exhorting his flocks to wrestle sin, when I said, "We are marching once more into the hostile storm which frantically perpetuates racism and sexism and can only answer our bitter, angry demands with guns and clubs." Fewer of us protested the presence of the American Legion than attended Vortex. The national media were disappointed we did not provide a bloody spectacle, as were several members of law enforcement. Proof that the confrontation was overblown from the beginning was apparent when President Nixon, who had planned to make a war speech to the Legion, sent in his place Vice President Spyrokakis T. Agnets, a Greek-American who referred to everybody else as Dagos, Fat Japs, etc. Some say Nixon was frightened of being attacked, possibly assassinated. I thought he realized the political insignificance of appearing in a substantially diminished public melodrama. The pre-convention display of hysteria had a sobering effect, and in the end, no one wanted to be responsible for the violence almost everyone feared or claimed to fear. Portland's residents did not wish a reputation for bloody civil war. That determined pressure to avoid violence was powerful enough to prevent it. And that was something I wrote. People's Army Jamboree. My most lasting memory of that event was my friend Arthur Honeyman being hoisted on the back of a very strong and tall man who had just served 19 months as a draft resister in jail. And he put Arthur on his shoulders. And this was when Agnew was in town, and he was surrounded by a sea, a virtual sea of cops and National Guards people. And Arthur, sitting on this man's shoulder, raised his spastic hand, his right arm, and gave the social finger in the real spastic, shaky manner, way in the air, above everything, to Agnew. And that is my fondest memory of that summer. Well, today is my birthday, and tomorrow's is one of my favorite and oldest friends in Oregon, a woman named Cher Zanera Rocksmith. And I found a sheaf of her adolescent poems in a box my sister had stored away in a locker for me. I met her when she was, well, actually she wasn't in school. She was 15 the day after I turned 29. And they were written when she was 15, a few months and weeks, perhaps even days, before I met her at a barricade during a protest against the Vietnam War. So she was actually 16 the day after I turned 29, I believe it was, 1970, yeah, 29. So I'd like to read these. We are all in waiting to see if something will take us and melt the past, which is only a reminder to a place where we listened and decided our futures. Now we are seeing ourselves carry pieces of blood-held decisions and pity for goodbyes. The breathing is silence to a whisper. Time in small curtain years, waiting far to weather and singing soft seclusion, songs, tomorrow's hours, yearning. I sought the children's laughter, their pushing through the lavenders, crying peoples hung up fears and burned them into fusion. Lining letters by a forest in a field, lilac-stained paper, for you, by the city, in a room, computer voices dictate loveless rumble for me. We are dead and ready to kill one another. The nature runs in a further silence than you could feel, the world embraced and tore to pain, in a hand we watched in waiting, children you stand in trial. Reflections passing through the window suns, scenes grasp in eyes that watch for lasting days to wander in, running to hold on to battles which lose themselves behind pouring concrete, show upon bone dust lying between the rocks rotting harshly, aged in losing sandstorms, hand-touched papers freeing themselves to melting waters, blackened letters flowing within unknown likeness, hands joined for firing brick rooms and grass-buried boxes. One decade waits lamenting serenity for another. You who listen, the plea, stop and see, we are of one. We try, hell is near, but we raise the downbeaten eyes in sunrise, cut our sanity wide open, and lay it out in heat-drenched fields. Cruelty could rob us blind, and gentleness leave uncertainties in hearing children's crying. Let us change fearless rage to compassion. Call, timeless child, no one will hear you, no one shall want you. For sadness could always be touching your mind. And that was a series of poems I kind of cobbled together by Cher Zanera, as she liked to call herself then. And her birthday is tomorrow. She still lives in Portland.